Welcome to the 35th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Timmy Chan.
And as England find themselves in chaos as the result of a few unpleasant text messages, welcome to the podcast where sticks and stones will break our bones, but names will never hurt us.
Yeah, there's been all sorts of extracurricular stuff going on recently, hasn't there? And it's going to be nice to see Lords returned from an archery. What do they call it? An archery ground? An archery pitch?
An archery venue?
Lane?
No, I can't do better
anyway,
than that. Yeah,
returned from archery to the proper stuff. But actually,
it looked good. Actually, I was sort of skeptical of the whole use of it, but I didn't go there live. But seeing on TV, it looked rather splendid.
The whole thing has been quite impressive. But what's also been quite nice is the way that county cricket has just sort of carried on in its own quiet little way in the background. And actually, one of my most pleasant days of the last couple of weeks has been I went down to Arundel for the first time to watch Surrey play against Northants. And it was a dreadful game of cricket. Northants are an absolute shower at the moment. But it's just the most beautiful day out, and you go and you park in this field in the middle of nowhere, and there's a sort of little folly at one end of the field, and you walk down through the woods, past the house, and out into the ground with, you know, the castle in the background, and it's all absolutely delightful. And actually, I mean, it completely reaffirmed my faith in not just in county cricket or in any sort of cricket, but in, I mean, I'm getting very misty-eyed now, but just in the idea of cricket per se, because it's the complete range of people who were there, firstly, was staggering. From, you know, the young little 7-year-olds who go along in their whites and play on the boundaries, through to, you know, the 95-year-olds who sit in
and
their
the lagerlouts like yourself,
and the lagerlouts like
well.
Ourselves, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I've wanted to go to Arundel very keenly, and it's those grounds that county cricket keeps alive, doesn't? Those beautiful sort of one-off venues,
completely. And what was nice, apart from just the range of people, is just the sort of the range of activities that cricket attracts, because it attracts a whole spectrum. The people who want to go and sit there just to have a day out, the people who sit there and, you know, score every ball, the people who sit there and chant vigorously on the boundaries, of which we were not one.
But you make the point that anything the Olympics has dominated, and deservedly so. I mean, it's a splendid event, but it's dominated in a complete way. And yet, I understand what you're saying, that it's nice in a way that county cricket has just meandered on.
And actually, there was a little bookstall out of the back of a van under a huge spreading oak tree, which I browsed during the tea interval, and I did just think this is simply heaven on earth.
Yeah.
So that's what's been keeping me getting on the cricketing front recently.
Well, I feel like I'm going to unfortunately have to drag us back to the reality. We were actually talking before the show about the fact that our podcast has certain themes, things that we just end up coming back to again and again. And I feel both my moment of excitement and my moment of depression of the last few weeks both fit those themes. My moment of excitement is the West Indies, as it so often is. They won the Test series against New Zealand, and it's easy to say, oh, it's New Zealand, they're useless.
New Zealand are good at the moment, aren't they? I mean, they're a real powerhouse in world cricket.
That was sarcasm,
it means
if you couldn't pick up on it. The reality is, West Indies have done a lot recently that's been promising, but it was getting to a stage after a promising defeat against Australia and a promising defeat against England. They had to do something. They had to win a series. And they won it, and they won it well. And it still gives them something. Two things to pick out of it. I'll pick three out. Chris Gayle's return, enough's been said about that. Excellent, excellent. Kieran Powell, lovely-looking opening batsman. I mean, his technique rather than his physical appearance. I'm sure he's a very good-looking individual as well. Played a lovely, lovely 100 in the first test, really. And especially for a guy who's only 21. And the most ridiculous thing is the transformation that goes on with Marlon Samuels. I mean, anyone who's followed his career, a few years back, he looked like this burnt-out prodigy. No mental strength, you know, fairly kind of trigger-happy, could score runs quickly. And suddenly, I would go as far, I'm going to say something slightly ridiculous now, he's of a consistency and of an ability on a par with almost any test batsman currently, like the runs he's scoring. If you look at the runs he scored in England, look at the runs he's just scored against the West Indies, he's just piling them. He's absolutely piling them up. Against England as well.
He's
made
the West
huge
Indies.
Numbers. So he's incredibly promising. And bizarrely, West Indies have found rather an interesting interesting talisman, and very surprising talisman in him. So away from a happy start, depress us.
Depress as well, yeah, absolutely. This whole KP scenario, which we're actually going to return to later on, we thought we'd give it give it sufficient airtime. And actually, it's probably, you know, if we log on to Crick Info in a couple of minutes, something else is going to happen, and someone else is going to throw their toys out of the pram. But I reckon that actually, what's let me down about the whole thing is actually, I have a conspiracy theory, but it's not really a conspiracy theory. I reckon that after a rainy summer, when he's had to play some miserable test matches against the West Indies, and then he sees the sort of bronze South Africans come across, you know, having spent, you know, most of the year lying on the beach having a great time with their blonde footballers' wives' girlfriends, that he has basically had enough of being in England. I think that's what it is. And I think he's actually feeling a bit homesick, and he's thinking, why on earth, when he sees all of the players not of colour, as it were, who have come through, which is obviously the reason he left initially. And he left because of that, and then he's come to England, and he's thought, well, what do I get in England?
Well, that
I get rain. I get a posh public schoolboy in the form of Andrew Strauss telling me off, plus a plus a Zimbabwean lording it over me. And so I'm actually pretty let down at the way that the, you know, it's the English weather.
The English weather. There's been pages written about this. Hours spent working, and that is a theory that has not been put down. It's original. I can certainly say that for it. Returning to one of our familiar themes, I'm going to briefly moan about 2020 cricket. The Sri Lankan Premier League has kicked off. If you've noticed that, then you spend too much time on Crick Info if you have noticed that.
Yeah. When Andy said that there was a Sri Lankan Premier League going on, I looked at him and said, oh, are they just setting it up?
It's underway. And my feeling about this is, you know, we've talked about it in the podcast before, and I don't want to, you know, I think 2020 has a role. I think it's actually, in its own way, a valuable part of the game, but in its place. And I just cannot be persuaded by the need for more than one mega 2020 league. And for better or for worse, the IPL is clearly the mega 2020 league. It attracts the best, it pays the biggest money.
I suppose the problem is that the IPL attracts people who are sort of established superstars. You all get together and play 2020. The problem when you start having a proliferation of smaller 2020 tournaments all over the world is you end up with 2020 becoming embedded sort of in the grassroots of cricket.
Yeah.
And actually, it's going to become what everyone learns by default, which is slightly the problem. And, you know, it's going to become, in a sense, the only route just because there's so many tournaments around.
I just think the vast majority of cricket fans will really struggle to care. And I think that may be what perhaps kills some of these leagues.
So watch out for fortnightly updates on our teams of choice.
From the SPL.
In the SPL. So, from the archives, Andy and I spent a few years together in Cambridge, and every summer there used to be the kind of whisper go round that the Lashings were in town. And this week, Andy is going to take us through the story of the Lashings Cricket Club.
Yeah, a side that now refers to themselves as the Lashings World 11, that often refers to themselves as sort of the greatest pub side in the world. There's a wonderful story behind them, as you'd expect. And the story has to start with their founder, David Folbe, who is the kind of guy you can't help but warm to. He's the classic wheeler dealer. You look at him.
He's a Del Boy.
And, you know, he's a bit of property, a bar owner on the side, you know, sort of all sorts of things going on. And one Saturday night, he heard that he's an owner of a Maidstone bar called Lashings, hence the name, heard that a nearby wine bar had a team and had been let down because the next day their opposition pulled out for the game. So they were looking for a side. And he said, don't worry, I've never played before, but I'm going to get a team together for you, which probably says something about the guy, doesn't it? He rang around his friends, got a team together in Lashings' first ever game against this wine bar. Their bowlers were sort of put around the park for 323, and they were then bowled out for 29. So Lashings didn't get off to sort of the most auspicious of starts. But it says a lot about Folbe that he persisted. He's not even, or was not at the start, even a cricket fan. So what it was that grabbed him about the game is interesting, because he's really a football fan. A couple of years later, having this side grown and grown, he signed two young, promising South Africans, one of which was Gary Kirsten, one of which was his maybe slightly less successful brother, Paul, to stiffen the Lashings batting order up. But the really, really decisive moment, and this kind of shows astonishing ambition for what, let's remember, was still pretty much a pub team, he signed former West Indies captain Richie Richardson. This was greeted by a leading sports journalist at the time saying that he would eat his hat if Richie Richardson ever actually played for Lashings. Richie Richardson did then appear for Lashings. We have no record of what happened to
do we know why these... Why did Gary Kirsten decide to...
Right.
I mean, because if I set up a public... Was he paying them?
Right, yes. He was absolutely paying them. Let's make no... You know, and Lashings fits in, and Lashings fits into this mould of sort of the entrepreneurial team. So we look right back in cricket's history at local pub landlords putting teams together, and Lashings beautifully fits that mould. And Fall paid, and it's interesting because we'll get on a little bit to sort of the financial model behind it, but from the start he was really just pouring his own money into this, and especially at the start it was not in any way profitable.
And for someone who doesn't like cricket, it seems
well, this is the bizarre thing. He genuinely claims that when he started Lashings he was a football fan, he had very little interest in it, and he paid Richie Richardson, again obviously details in this are very very hard to come by, but presumably a considerable amount of money to join Lashings, a considerable amount of money. And suddenly, the real genius of the move, though, was that it set off a kind of chain reaction.
Yep.
Because suddenly...
Once you have one, other people are going to follow.
Exactly. And Richardson's contact book was such that Lashings... And I think that's... Lashings is, in many ways, the story of Forbes' genius, really. I mean, genius might be strong, but sort of strategy. He got Richardson in and suddenly was creating this extraordinary team. And the Lashings website puts it rather arrogantly, but it says the list of international players great internationals who haven't played for them is almost shorter than the list who have. It is extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, Tendulkar, Lara, Akram, Walsh, you know, they've all played. It's extraordinary.
What's interesting is the way that actually they've been able to recreate some of the kind of amateurism, the sort of amateur atmosphere of the game, which has been completely lost. So I remember coming to see them when they played at Fenner's here in Cambridge, where, you know, you pay a fiver to get in, everyone just sits around the boundary, you have, you know, 21-year-olds at university bowling to them. No one really cares. Everyone has a few drinks.
And I think you've pinpointed something quite specific, because they say they're very much stressed the fact that fun, I mean, it sounds a bit of an odd thing to say, but fun is there fundamentally. And they've right from the start...
That is such a tacky slogan.
It is incredibly tacky. As I said it, I realised I'll tell you. But they play the spirit in quite a game in quite a light-hearted way. And as you're right, you know, they will play village sides across the country. That's very much their kind of... The sort of standard opposition. There has been some controversy in recent years because Lashings has grown and grown and grown, and I think there's a fear that it's turned into something of a kind of corporate machine. Lashings don't just turn up and pay for nothing. You as a club now have to contribute and pay them to turn up. However,
does that not go to charity?
Well, this is the interesting thing. However, they do still make huge amounts of money for charity. And once your average club has, as you've said, you know, asked for some admission money, made money in sort of various other ways at the ground, it's presumably okay. But it has been controversial in that way. It's also worth noting that this has not ever been really a money-making exploit for Fulb. It might be an ego trip, but it hasn't been for that. Lashings barely breaks even, really, as a concept for him. I just thought it'd be interesting to talk through a couple of the sort of the current players in the squad to give an idea of sort of the flavour at present.
Yeah.
You've got Henry Alonga there, which is quite extraordinary because for someone who, I mean, what an astonishing career he had, both as a player and then, of course, his black armband protest. And he sort of found a home at Lashings almost after, you know, after a very difficult end to his career. It was astonishing to find out that Gordon Greenidge, now 61, is still turning out for Lashings and still doing very, very well. Well, Lou Vincent, who's a kind of quite an interesting figure, like a New Zealand sort of big hitter of real natural ability, but he's had these long, kind of quite well-documented struggles with depression, and they've made it quite difficult for him to ever establish himself at international level. I was particularly enjoyed reading about his innings of 243 off 93 balls against Woodhall Spa CC. I mean, you can imagine the amateur bowlers chuntering in.
This is the other thing, that you sometimes do get these amazing mismatches, but it also gives people the chance to... I remember the time that Tendulkar was out in a match in Cambridge. He was out LBW. Can you imagine, as a 21-year-old bowler, getting out Sachin Tendulkar? I mean, it would be a pretty... amazing things to do, really. Isn't it?
But I think you've sort of got it spot on in that what they offer, really, is a chance for your average village cricketer, I mean, even your good village cricketer,
to have a moment in the limelight.
Right, yeah. In some cases, almost to fulfil dreams. I mean, who doesn't dream of bowling to Sachin Tendulkar?
I have not even batting against Sachin Tendulkar.
Or batting against, you know, a Henry Along. You know, it's a great opportunity for this.
Again, I don't dream about batting against Sachin. But yeah, I see your point completely. Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think it brings kind of, and you think about it, how many other sports offer that as an opportunity? Very few amateur footballers will ever get the chance. So it offers something quite extraordinary. And I mean, for this kind of controversy over the financial model and the fact that clubs do now have to pay them to come, they do offer something incredibly exciting. And it's interesting how they're inundated, not surprising, with fixture requests. You know, clubs are desperate to get a bit of this magic.
So does that mean that they've effectively got a pretty strong future? I mean, is this the model that they're going to carry on, or are there other developments
in store? Well, the future of Lashings, I think, is intriguing, because I was astonished to read, actually, that a couple of years ago, it was genuinely being debated whether they might be able to come into the 2020 league in England and play alongside the counties. Mm. And I thought this was really quite surprising. That debate's gone away. And I think the IPL has made a side like Lashings seem maybe a little bit quaint, actually, because in its own way, the IPL is basically a division, a league stacked full of World 11s, isn't it? I mean, from the Rajasthan Royals to the, I can't think of the name of another IPL team, to the Mumbai Indians. And Lashings, because Lashings is this rather quirky mix of current pros who haven't quite made it, to great former players just on the off.
What's interesting about the difference between Lashings and the teams of Alan Stanford and Jerry Packer, the two that spring to mind, is actually they're not trying, while they are trying to be a team of very, very good players, they never play against very, very good teams, do they?
No. For the vast majority of the time, no. I mean, they've done things like they played against the United Arab Emirates, so they've played against international sides.
They don't play against...
No, you're right, they haven't played against...
So they're not like the Barbarians. So in fact, in a sense, they're in a slightly different mould.
No, you're right. That's an interesting comparison to something like the Barbarians in rugby. They're not... You're quite right. They're trying to, rather than compete with the best, they're almost trying to bring the best to the rest. God,
that's another great slogan. The best to the rest and the fun in the fundamentals.
And the players seem to have so much fun. It does seem to be a lovely way of kind of keeping a career alive. There was some nice footage of Dean Headley playing for them. And I have a real affection for players like Dean Headley. Those kind of, those triers
who
from
had
England's
to live
fallow
years of Wellington, which is absolutely shocking.
So I think, just to sort of sum up, I mean, I think the story of Lashings is a very typical cricketing story of entrepreneur made good in some way, created something interesting in cricket, and they've certainly become a fixture of the English game and a highlight for many, many village teams. To the book review, and this episode we're looking at The Fast Men by David Frith. And Frith, in kind of justifying why he wrote this book, said that there's plenty of cricket literature dedicated to the batsmen, that he says they're traditionally seen as the heroes of the game. And he said he felt a need almost to correct that balance, and he felt that for so many fans, going to watch cricket had often been about the sheer joy of watching someone bowl a cricket ball very, very fast. And what he's done, really, is told a sort of 200-year story of many of the different men who've kind of made fast bowling.
One of the things that I find really engaging about Frith as a writer is that he does have these kind of crusades, in a sense, you know, to rescue the fast bowler from oblivion. And when I think probably a lot of people, I certainly got to know him through his columns in The Wisden Cricketer, called Frith's Encounters, where, I mean, he is the most remarkably knowledgeable writer probably there is around. He was born in England, moved to Australia, lived in Australia with his family. His family emigrated to Australia, lived there for 20 years, I think, moved back to England in the 60s. And he has kind of met anyone and everyone, and he has got certainly a sort of vast corpus of cricket literature, which is absolutely fascinating.
There is a connection between Frith's Encounters and this, because both of them show he has this wonderful kind of eye for a personality, doesn't it?
He does.
That seems to be really fascinating.
One of the things where cricket literature is both so rich, but it also falls down, is when talking particularly about the 19th century, is that it stops seeing cricketers as personalities and starts to seeing them as sort of stats. And he has a really amazing way of bringing the players off the page. And that's one of the really interesting things about this book, because he goes all the way back to the beginning of fast bowling and talks about when fast bowling was underarm and then the way that it, you know, became roundarm and overarm. And he really manages to bring through some of the characters in the games.
Well, I think the book is a triumph as a collection of lots and lots of great mini biographies. And for me, the pleasure was in finding out about finding new angles to the people who I knew, you know, the Trumans, the sort of Tysons who I knew, and also finding kind of entirely new figures, to totally discover new figures. If I would say it's one weakness, and this is slightly, this is a is not really a fair criticism because it's not what the book is trying to be, I wanted more on the story of fast bowling. In a way, I would really have appreciated maybe a slightly more technical book, perhaps looking at how the evolution, really focusing on the evolution of fast bowling. But to be fair to Frith, that's not what he's trying to write. That's not the book he's trying to write.
No, he's not. He's trying to write about the fast bowlers, and they're, as you said, the book is made up of a series of sort of little snapshots of time when. So, for instance, one of the chapters that I absolutely love. For some reason, I don't know why it is. I'm really into the 20s at the moment. In terms of not in terms of dress or music or anything, just in terms of cricket. And there's a fantastic chapter about the Australian fast bowling pair of Gregory and McDonald. And what he does really interestingly is he sort of takes a snapshot and he gives you an overview of individuals, and then he also sort of raises some of the bigger issues about fast bowling. So, for instance, he talks about the way in which fast bowlers often bowl in pairs, and you think about a lot of the great fast bowlers, and they're always in pairs.
Hunting as a pack, aren't
they? And in slightly, they always bring slightly different attributes to them. So, for instance, Jack Gregory was this. Jack Hobbs described his run up as like an elephant stampede, and then McDonald was like a silk handkerchief approaching the crease. This idea that fast bowlers are in a sense only as good as their partners, as it were. Whether sometimes it's a keeper, sometimes it's another fast bowler, is something that kind of recurs throughout the book.
I think sort of on the subject of kind of the biography side of it, I was interested in those players who you've kind of encountered in cricket literature but never quite got sort of deeply behind. And I had a sort of very interesting experience with reading about Fred Spofforth, who I guess most English
people know. I had a really interesting experience with Fred Spofforth.
Well, he's a player who you're familiar with, the founding of the Ashes, you kind of know of. But getting kind of some of the detailed kind of background was very entertaining. I mean, even just these moments, how he declared before that famous, you know, Ashes creating bowling performance, "This thing can be done," growled Spofforth. And I thought, God, you know, it's wonderful. Yeah. And also, particularly, you get Frith does take an interest in kind of what they were kind of aside from a cricketer. So he's happy to spend lots and lots of words talking about the fact that he looked after his chrysanthemums and lived happily in Walton on Thames. It's quite pleasant to get this sort of side story.
This personality thing is really interesting because you always get this image of fast bowlers sort of being these sort of emotionless beasts. And so when you have details of that, like looking after the chrysanthemums, deadheading the chrysanthemums, but also the flip side is that a lot of fast bowlers at the end of their careers, so batsmen can kind of go on for quite a long time. Batsmen don't get horrific injuries which just render them completely incapable of doing their job. Whereas bowlers do quite a lot. And in fact, you were reading about someone, weren't you, who was
right. I mean, you've picked out, I think, quite a I guess in a maybe an accidental theme that kind of emerges from the book, this idea that that there are a lot of kind of very, very sad endings to a lot of careers. There's a really interesting figure, Foghorn Jackson, and we're going back quite a way here in the sort of, you know, the kind of cricketing heritage. And we have this player who was seen by many as the quickest there's kind of ever been, an astonishing pace bowler who built his career at Nottinghamshire. known as the demon, known as the foghorn for the rather wonderful reason that he would blow his nose after taking a wicket. But you have a career described by Frith actually as one of the most tragic of cricket lives, because he suffered what seems like a relatively minor injury while chasing a ball at Trent Bridge. He never really was able to establish himself again and ultimately died in the workhouse, was given a pauper's burial. And it's kind of... you read that and it is quite a jolt to your sensibilities, because actually we're so used to an age where the idea of a professional sportsman or
completely broke.
Right, it is, and you think of the high and the low that life is involved, from performing in front of thousands to...
What I really like about a lot of Frith's writing, what really annoys me about a lot of bad cricket writing, is a lot of bad cricket writers go, you know, they go back to the 30s and all they talk about is the difference between amateurs and professionals.
Mm.
And Frith doesn't really mention it as that kind of seismic a difference. But there certainly is this sort of theme that runs throughout, which is that, you know, the reason that fast bowlers could go off and die with no money is because they were the professionals. They were the people who had to earn their money playing cricket, whereas the batsmen were the people who had, you know, the fortunes behind them and the fathers with the castles that they, you know, always had to fall back on. And you do get very subtly coming through in the book just this sense of the sort of difference in attitudes towards them, and also the different roles that they sort of fulfilled in... within teams, and the idea that with a, you know, actually it's a fast bowler who can really sort of flummox a team. There's a great stat that in 1921, two Australian fast bowlers touring England with all the, you know, they used to play hundreds of county matches back then, two Australian fast bowlers took over 200 wickets between them in the summer. And England in five tests used 31 players, because they just had no idea
how to play.
Yeah. And the way that fast bowlers can just come to utterly dominate the mindset of an opposition, I think, is really sort of borne out.
You're right, and I guess the book, it's not something the book explicitly tries to talk about, but you just pick it up, don't you, through these stories of so many greats, and you kind of end up agreeing with Frith that actually, perhaps for its sheer kind of power, there is nothing quite in cricket like watching a genuine quick bowling in his prime.
So, to the debate. In last episode, we talked about whether Lords should have a roof in light of all the rain going on. And Andy was quite... sorely thrashed, if I do say so myself. And
it's been an exchange of ideas.
He's been slightly unhappy about this, and he's assured me that this week we have a motion that he cannot but fail to wipe the floor with. So let's see. I mean, it'll be even more humiliating if you don't win. And we're going to discuss whether England have only themselves to blame for the Kevin Peterson situation.
It's a good debate, this, because firstly, we both genuinely disagree. So if we do get sort of aggressive or loud, that's because we do genuinely disagree over this.
Genuine emotion, that's what
now,
you tune in for, dear viewers.
Kevin Peterson's 149 at Headingley was declared by Michael Vaughan after watching it as a once-in-a-decade innings, at a time when England's other batsmen seemed barely capable of hanging around at the crease. I mean, there was a nice kind of contrast with James Taylor, who, to be fair to him, played a very plucky knock at the other end, and KP, for whom it was effortless. It was a beautiful, beautiful innings. And it was a reminder for anyone who needed reminding, you'd have to be very silly to need reminding, that KP is an extraordinary batsman. He is, for all his ups and downs and personality, the standout batsman of this generation for England. And whether his personality is that of a maverick or not, his ability means he needs to be tolerated, he needs to be brought into the fold in the same way Botham was, in the same way a Flintoff was, and it is a failure on behalf of England that they haven't realised that and recognised his importance. Let's look at the key issues here. Firstly, KP's request over could he pick and choose the amount of cricket he played. Is it unreasonable, given his age, given everything he's contributed to England, for example, to miss the odd minor ODI series, to miss the odd, you know, the odd game here and there? It seems to me a relatively reasonable request, and a request that, interestingly, the vast majority of other competitive test nations would have been willing to grant a player. England's intransigence there caused the first problem. The reaction now over this, these text messages that have been said is ludicrous. It's absurd to chastise a player for what ultimately, at the end of the day, you're irritated, you're slightly upset. You send the odd frivolous, banterous text to a couple of your mates.
No, hang on. They're not dropping him because he sent the messages. They're dropping him because he refuses to say what he sent the messages about. And I think there's a difference between that. They're not saying you sent some text messages to some South Africans, therefore we're going to drop you. They are saying you can't just undermine. Did you undermine Strauss and Flower?
So the South Africans have literally said today, the South African manager has literally used the word today to say the text messages were banter. They were harmless. And the same stuff that players will exchange the entire time.
The South African management might well backtrack and distance themselves from the whole thing. But I wouldn't, the word banter can mean anything really, can't it?
I can't see... For me, I should probably say this right now, I have huge respect for... I mean, I can't see how you can't have huge respect for both Andrew Strauss as a captain and Andy Flower as a coach, but I can't have a feeling that they are taking this too seriously. And this mantra that keeps being quoted of team unity, team unity, team unity. If team unity means overreacting to what seems to me a fairly harmless text message, if team unity means basically alienating a maverick, like a genuine talent who... may have a personality that grates on a few people.
Okay, so in terms of the idea of overreaction to the idea of team unity, I mean, it kind of means to... I think the whole thing is slightly more black and white than... I don't think England are entirely to blame and KP has got absolutely nothing to do with the whole thing. And England should just say, you can do exactly what you want, we don't care, just come and turn up and bat well and that's all we ask of you. Cricket teams simply can't function on that basis. And I think the point with KP is that ultimately he knows he can get away with it. And his maverickness is, is best exhibited when he, pulls balls from 2 feet outside off stump and sends them over deep mid-wicket.
But would you accept the basic idea that there are difficult personalities who need to be tolerated, they need to be brought in?
But he doesn't. What annoys me about KP is that he's not a maverick personality in the same way that... Okay, so Flintoff was... ultimately, occasionally he went out, got drunk, sat in a pedalo, and that was about it. But what he didn't do was basically to say, I am bigger than the team that I am in, which is what Peterson does, and neither Flintoff nor actually both of them ever did, and it's what Peterson is deliberately rubbing rubbing the nose of the England management in by the fact that he says. I'm going to play. But he doesn't say it to the England management. He says it in a video that he releases on YouTube as some kind of grand, magnanimous statement that, I'm going to make myself available to English cricket. And I love English cricket. Well, you quite clearly don't if you're not actually willing to talk to the people who are within. If he was suddenly saying, oh, I have all this goodwill. So they had this meeting, on Saturday or whenever it was. And he said after it, oh, yeah, all the issues are out in the open. It's all fine. We're all happy now. If that was actually the case, then why on earth did he then have to go completely behind the management's back and pronounce to the... You don't... I mean, that is just the most incredibly arrogant thing to do.
We'll come back to the video, but let's rewind. I think the Flintoff and Botham comparison is really, really important. Because the Flintoff comparison... Kevin Peterson, for whatever he has done, has never done anything as disrespectful to his side or, frankly, the entire cricketing sporting community to be as unprofessional as to get drunk in a pedalo in the middle of a major international competition.
Oh, no, I disagree. I'm sorry.
I mean, let me finish
completely
on this. Flintoff's action there for a professional sportsman in what was a major, major tournament, a World Cup opportunity where England had genuine prospects of doing well, was disrespectful to the entire England cricketing
There wasn't the same degree of calculated intention about the whole thing that there is about Kevin. I'm sorry, but there was a huge degree of calculated intention about saying, I'm going to make myself available to play for England, but I'm not going to tell the England management that. I'm going to record a video and put it on YouTube and tell them what. Yeah. That is so calculated. And it's so.
I don't think it's calculated. What I think we could agree on is if we were debating the size of Kevin Peterson's ego, we would not be having a debate.
No.
I would agree as quickly as the next man. He is a man of astonishing arrogance. I'd also say, as a caveat to that, by the way, that I think very few great sportsmen come without a fair bit of arrogance. But the video was misguided entirely as an idea. But what I would say is, A, would have never got to that stage, I think, if things had been managed better at the start. And B, I think the intentions of the video at least were positive. I mean, the intentions were literally, I've made a mistake here, I'm going to make myself available.
No, hang on. He never says he's made a mistake. Okay, he doesn't say that at all. Well, he says it's difficult being me in this England dressing room. He never says, and this is absolutely true, he will never say that he is wrong. He hasn't said that he's wrong.
Well, he's implicitly said he's wrong.
Which is exactly...
Because he's gone back on what he said before.
This is exactly why he does say
he's reassessed what's important
in his text messages.
Ultimately,
I don't think... Is it not... Okay, so... Flintoff was in the middle of a World Cup tournament which England could have won, and he got drunk and went and sat on the pedalo. KP is in England and number one test nation for the first time in God knows how long.
Yeah.
And have a chance to win it.
Yeah.
And he is the one who's... I was about to swear, we're not allowed to do that because we have a family-friendly race.
Wow, if you had just lost this off,
mucking about in a... By doing all of this, rather than just saying, okay, I'll play, I'm not going to make this whole thing public. Because he's the one who's made the whole thing public the middle of a test series. Now that, I don't see how you can say that that's
coming back to the debate, two very easy ways...
Oh, that is
ways.
The debate.
Coming
don't
back
just,
to
don't
the topic of the debate.
Question.
Two very easy
question,
ways that the ECB could have defused this. Point one, when KP first suggested, I want to retire from ODI cricket, the ECB could easily have agreed
have
on a series
all its
of concessions.
Rules to one person.
They could have agreed on a series of sensible intelligence.
Because that would have been really good morale for the rest of the side saying, okay, there's one rule for the rest of you, and KP's so good that we're going to create a completely
why
new
was
set
it,
of
why
standards
was it okay,
for him.
Why was it okay to rest Jimmy Anderson for the West Indies ODIs and not rest KP?
But there's no hard and fast rule. The ECB has a stated rule that people are not allowed. They have to play both ODI and T20s or none of them. They couldn't have just said, what would that have done to the entire team if they'd said, okay, you know, Kevin Peterson can do differently, but the rest of you just have to put up and shut up because he's such a good
player. Perhaps the rigidity of the rule does need to be assessed.
Okay,
is it useful?
That's a completely different argument.
And then
the fact
secondly,
that there is a rule, and that's a boring point, so you've got
to bear that point. Just to discuss on that point, the ECB's inflexibility has been mistaken for strength. They've tried to say, we will not compromise for KP, and what they've ended up doing is putting themselves in this situation. The text messages situation could have been dealt with better. It could clearly have been dealt with better. Yeah. I just think, let's just move away. There's a lot of other very interesting points to say this, but we're running out of time. Let's turn this to a very much more basic level. Put yourself in the position of an England fan who's waited for this series, I guess, as we all have. It's a great series. Far, far better. Gutted that it's only three tests, but far better than the sham that was last summer, where a very average India team in the end got hammered by England. This is an excellent South Africa team contesting with a very good England team for the world number one. England fans will see Lords, and they will see a Lords side with Johnny Bairstow and James Taylor, two Test cricket novices who, frankly, will
be without their one genuinely great batsman.
You're effectively handing the world number one ranking over to South Africa.
That's the result of it. But I think the jury is set out on the fact of whether I do not think for a moment that you can absolve KP of all blame for this situation at all. I think he's demonstrated throughout that he is quite willing to play himself off against it. Yes, the ECB haven't helped themselves, but he has known exactly how to do the wrong thing, basically, all the way through.
Well, that was fun. And to be fair, by the time we've got around to uploading this podcast, this will all be changed, and KP will probably be back as England captain, and Strauss will be sacked. In fact, you know, who knows? But anyway, in the meantime, well, we all look forward in anticipation to see how England will go in that final test. And we will be back with you sometime in the near future.